Okay. Who is there? Good evening. This is Maria. Who is there?
Karen, good afternoon or evening, wherever you are.
Thank you so much for greeting. That's nice. I was waiting for Laverne because I need to tell her something. I was looking for someone to help me with the coaching hours. But
yes.
It seems that she's not here yet. It seems that the hours that she has is not working for me. So.
Oh, really?
And I need to finish with hours, but the hours that she gave me are not suitable for me. Do you finish with your coaching thing or no?
Yes, a couple of years back, but I just couldn't get it off the ground.
What happened?
Yes. Well, the area that I am in is very, very poor, and the majority of the population is on social services. So it was very difficult to, you know, try to get it off the ground and actually make some sort of money with it, because I took the coaching because I wanted to quit my job and go into it, but, you know, it didn't work out. It didn't work out. Or somebody would come to one coaching session, and I would just charge them for that one session at a very low price, and they just wouldn't show up again because they don't see a need in counseling. They don't see a need in coaching, you know. So it's
I understand. Very simple. And we need an income. We need something fixed. I know. I'm coming from the same background like you. I understand very clear.
You need to have a job. It was disappointing, but, you know, I still use it. I mean, sometimes people come to me, they just need to talk, and, you know, I let them talk their way through. It's not like a total loss. It's just that I'm not making a living at it, and I get kind of disappointed. It's a lot of coaches in this area, I found out, and they're going through the same thing.
Thank you for sharing with me. That's my
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're
very
welcome.
Very wonderful. What is your name, son?
Karen,
sorry. I said at the beginning, I'm Maria. So nice.
Maria.
Yes. It's nice to hear that. I'm not the only one. But yes, the same here. But you finished with school, no? You have the certificate and everything.
Yes.
Okay. That's the piece that I'm trying to get, you know, the certificate, and then the rest, I will know.
Right. I didn't get the other certificate, what you're talking about. You need so many hours of actual coaching. I didn't do that because, like I said, again, it was a real problem getting people to sit down and, you know, do this and, you know, and then my boss got involved and, you know, you're not supposed to be doing this. You know, that type of crap. So I just didn't go any further with it. But I do let people know I'm available if they need my services, you know.
Yeah. You never know.
Yeah. I wonder, I'm sure they're going to have class tonight, right?
Well,
we're the only two on the line? Oh, we're a little early. Okay.
I'm glad we're early.
Hi, this is Rob. I'm on the line, too.
Okay, cool. Hi, Mr. Davis.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, how's good. There's more people joining. So where is everybody located?
I'm in Maryland.
I'm in Northern Virginia.
No kidding. Okay, and I'm from Buffalo, New York.
I wonder where everyone else is.
Such a beautiful state.
This is from Connecticut. This is Maria from Connecticut. You were talking with me. Yes, Connecticut.
Oh. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Maria. Good night, everyone.
So we're on seminar 3 tonight, right?
Yes.
Think so. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Well, welcome. This is Dave. I hope you guys are doing great. We're going to
Hello.
Talk about... Hey.
Hello.
Hi. We're going to talk about some of the mind and brain science about writing in this seminar, and then in our final seminar next week, we're going to talk about what do you do with it, the different publishing options, and looking at various aspects of the business of writing. So as we move into this aspect, questions, thoughts, or reflections that you have at this point might be helpful to briefly discuss before we move into our material.
I do have a question, Mr. David.
This is who?
Maria Diaz.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. David. I have a question. I still have the question. If I, in my memoir, if I can include the names or if I can switch the names of real, you know, real characters, or if I need to notify them before I write the story. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know what the nature of your memoir is, but I think it's probably a good idea. If you're revealing information about people and going to name them, that you let them know, because that way there's no surprises. They probably will be honored. They probably will want to contribute and add some more, but I think it's a good idea just so there are no surprises, to circumvent any glitches or problems that that you may have. Because when you enter into the relationship or the discussions with these people, it wasn't with the understanding that it would be revealed to the public. So you're changing the framework. So that's a good idea. Remember when you're coughing and coughing into your microphone, we're all hearing it. So please, especially for that, if you would mute. So just check with them. It's a good idea to do that. Is there any... trepidation you have about checking?
Yes. No. I had no trepidation regarding that. I just want to make sure that I'm on the right route.
Yeah. They'll probably be among your biggest supporters if
thank you.
You're talking about them. Yeah.
Well, I have a question. I'm sorry. This is Karen. Would you suggest that you have them sign something if you use these people? That, you know, they can't come back and sue you?
I don't know the answer to that. If you have things that that you're worried about, I just don't know how to answer that, because if you're just talking about people and giving illustrations and that sort of thing, there shouldn't be any problem. If you're revealing something that might compromise somebody, then you may look at how you protect yourself. So I don't know the answer to that question. But it's always useful to be cautious if you feel you need to protect yourself or the person.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet. Other thoughts, questions, reflections about anything we've talked about or haven't so far? Any other things that might be helpful?
Hi, Dave. This is Rob. I got a question.
Yeah, hey. Go ahead.
My name is...
So I'm in the process of turning my dissertation into a book. And, of course, you know, with dissertations, there's the references and there's the, you know, it's just very kind of technical, choppy writing. So what I'm concerned about is do I need to reference, like, every sentence like I did in the dissertation, or how much freedom would you recommend or how much latitude so that it just seems like it would read easier? Right now, like, every sentence is referenced with, like, a superscript.
Okay, who is your book intended for, the intended audience?
Ah, very good question. The intended audience would be recruiters of physicians, maybe physicians, maybe folks who are looking for the services of a physician.
Okay. Okay, well, I think you have a good question, because you're distinguishing two very fundamental different types of writing, academic writing and trade writing. I'm very familiar. The first 12 books I did were for other shrinks, psychoanalysts, other people in the medical profession. I made a transition, and ever since it's been for a trade audience. It's totally different. People who want to read your book for information and are not in an academic field will be tripped up and won't stick with you very long if it's all referenced and it's not a smooth flow of easy reading. So have your intended audience in mind to communicate with them what you want to communicate. Now, when you wrote technically for your dissertation, you're writing for an academic audience and an academic committee and a dissertation committee. Think about who you're writing to and start telling your story in a different way, in a fluid and conversational way with that person or those people in mind, like you'd really be talking to them. Because if you sat down, had a glass of wine after this COVID stuff is all over, and started with one of the people you're writing to, like you've written before with the reference stuff, I think that they'd, you know, think of something they had to do at home real quick. You know?
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much.
You know, talk,
I appreciate that.
Talk to the people you want to talk to.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
So here's a different way of saying that. You're not in the business of finding readers for your words. You're in the business of finding words for your reader. That's why you want to know a good deal about who your reader is. So here's an exercise for everybody, and I'm thinking of it, and thanks to Rob, but this is an exercise for everybody. On your page, draw a circle, just a big circle. Inside that circle, put a stick figure. Now, that stick figure is your reader. For that person to listen to you, you're going to have to get inside the circle, because outside the circle, they're not going to listen to you more than they would anybody else. Your challenge is to get inside the circle. And to get inside the circle, you need to know what their challenge is. You need to know how to talk to them so that they'll want to listen. And that together, then, from that common ground, once you've entered that circle, you can go someplace new together. Any other? I hope that brief discussion was helpful, Rob.
It was. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Other thoughts or questions?
Thank you. That's been good.
I'm sorry. Were you talking?
Yes, I was talking and saying that was good. Highlight. Thank you.
Okay. Any other thoughts or questions or comments that would be useful for all of us before we move into our material? Okay, well, anything comes up, jot it down, and I'll reserve some time at the end for us to discuss, because this especially may raise some questions and some possible discussion for you. Okay, we're going to talk about really the neuroscience of writing. Anne Lamott, I think this is in your outline. Anne Lamott said so much of writing is about sitting down and doing it every day, and so much of it is about getting into the custom of talking in everything that comes along, seeing it as all grist for the mill. This can be a very comfortable habit, like biting your nails. And she said that in Bird by Bird, which is one of the best books on writing that exists. I'm a particular fan of Anne Lamott. We share a good friend, but her writing is terrific. So first, let's talk about your comfort zone. To write and publish your first book, you're going to have to leave your comfort zone. A comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process initially, but once established, resists change. So think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. An increase or a decrease in room temperature signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and our brains both contribute to the maintenance of our comfort zone. We return to the familiar even if we don't like it, even if it's uncomfortable or limiting. A comfort zone is predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. It can be a repeated role that we play in a relationship, like an attachment pattern, a repeated pattern like procrastinating to make needed lifestyle changes. It can take various forms. For example, bargaining with yourself about seriously writing or really completing your book within a specific time frame. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. You break the script. A routine is broken. Remember that a habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Here's a very simple example. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they wore headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an upside-down image consistently 24 hours a day. So they had to learn to adjust to everything they did because they were in the headgear 24 hours a day, up for down, reversing everything, carefully thinking through and reversing in their mind the plan of what they needed to do. Then, about day 25, they all noticed that something remarkable had happened. Their brains had rewired, had automatically made the adjustments, so they didn't need to do this anymore. Their brains had rewired and developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts, the same headgear, were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. So this speaks to consistency of doing something that's new and different. Your performance, even the money you make, writing the book that you write in a consistent way operates in a similar way. And if people, as you know, get more successful, they begin to feel vaguely uncomfortable, just different. If you make more money than fits with your self-image, it cues that internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. Here's an example of that. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound earnings to return to their previous situation. In the United States, just over 80% of lottery winners of $3 million or more file bankruptcy within the first 5 years after their win. Their money changed, but their mindset didn't. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious, and you can reprogram your mind and brain. Your mind can reframe. Your brain can rewire. So one possibility here is to simply make a habit of writing. Construct a schedule and be loyal to that schedule. Then it will feel weird when you don't stick to the schedule. So, how you frame something can change the meaning. And meaning derives from a frame we place around an event or a situation. So that means the structure of meaning is an inside job. each meaning and each frame is yours to construct. It's not there until you create it. Here's a simple example. Well, I have too much going on right now to find time to write. Reframed, I have too much going on right now not to create specific scheduled time to write. It's a way I take care of myself. Your response, your perception of an experience and a meaning you attribute is the bridge between the external event and your internal state and experience. To determine any meaning, we need a context to frame it. And that frame can be initially your state of mind. The reticular activating system at the base of the brain decides what's allowed into consciousness out of all the million bits of information streaming into the brain. For example, right now, pay attention to your feet. Focus specifically on how your feet feel as you wiggle your toes, as you move them back and forth on the floor. Feel the warmth and the sensation that you have from them. Now, your feet have been there all along, but you simply cued your reticular activating system to attend to your feet and get that feedback. You pay attention to whatever fits into your life story, the framework you use. Now, let's examine how this reality affects the story of your book. For example, part of your life story is your self-image. If somebody says something really nice about you that you don't believe, it probably won't register. It'll be disavowed with an internal comment like, well, what are they trying to sell me? Natural filters include beliefs, self-image, goals. So how do you reframe? How do you reprogram your reticular activating system to focus on your book, to achieve what you want in writing your book? Here's the key to this discussion on framing. Your book outline is more than your blueprint and your plan. It's your framework. When you start writing about something specific, examples of it begin to appear. It's as if the universe is conspiring to help you achieve your goal. Yellow Jeeps keep appearing. You can't get away from them. I first had a series of experiences in psychoanalysis that I now have in a very related way in mentor coaching. My patients at the time, who were therapists or psychoanalysts in training, working with me, would notice that as soon as they worked through a particular psychological issue and came to terms with it, suddenly they had half a dozen of their own patients that would bring up that very issue that they had just dealt with. And they were always amazed at it. Their patients had been unconsciously taking a number, patiently waiting until it was their turn. Those of you who are professional coaches no doubt have noticed and will notice the same thing with your clients. They will wait for you to get your arms around something so you can help them with theirs. Now, as authors, you'll notice it again, and it will pertain to what you're writing. For example, in the first few months after the release of an earlier book, The Secret Language of Money, along with beginning a licensed specialty certified training program for financial coaches and professionals, my clients began giving me illustrations. Their money stories were there at center stage, needing to be coached. That's what the law of attraction tells us. Whatever you focus on, you will both notice and bring about in co-creation. So here's a really simple three-step combination to reframe and incorporate your new endeavor. One is visualization. You can create powerful and stimulating internal images. Remember the very first task I had you do before we ever started doing anything together was to write down the title of your book, to draw the picture of your book. Visualization reprograms the reticular activating system by programming awareness. It cues your radar. Affirmations the positive validation of doing and being what you want, or the story that supports those visualizations. Affirmations constitute the story that frames and supports the visualization. To allow yourself to be creative, you have to move ahead even though you're afraid of being wrong or not knowing. Affirmations will provide a sense of safety as well as hope. 2. Change your behavior to precisely what you want. New behavior, new experiences create new pathways in the brain. With each repetition, those pathways become more deeply etched. As soon as they're well grooved, you'll have a new habit, an automatic behavior, the default mode. Your future self lives in your present mind. If you clearly visualize that future self, you can then move ahead to actualize that vision. So let's look at the neuroscience of a vision, especially applied to your writing. What we know from brain studies is that visualization brings about actual physical changes in the brain. And the brain assimilates a mental picture, whether the stimulus is imagined, as in visualization, or actual coming through the optic nerve. Same pathway and same stimulation. Brain can't tell the difference, whether it comes from the optic nerve or from your imagining in the prefrontal cortex. Replays of the visualization, such as repeating the vision of successfully attaining the goal of completion of your book, for example, program neural networks and neuronal pathways to more strongly etch the experience. Remember, whatever gets repeated gets rewired by the brain. PET scans have also established that thoughts bring about physical changes in your brain. When you program your unconscious, you actually create a future memory to live into. That visualization is a future memory that actually changes your brain. And the brain can't tell who conjured it, you or reality. The more detailed your visual image, the more specifically etched your brain will be. Now, here's the important aspect, I think. You don't make the brain change permanent unless you incorporate it into your story. Remember that the most powerful force of the human psyche is your identity. So if you make changes and do maybe some behavioral change and don't incorporate that to transform your identity along with the behavioral change, you'll revert back to the way it was before, because we always return to our identity. As you know from being mentor coaches, evolving that identity in a transformative way is one of the most powerful impacts that we can have in doing work with clients. And this may be, for example, why 95% of people who diet and lose significant weight gain back their weight. They don't reprogram their body image. Envision the experience of your completed book, not of getting there, but of being there, of announcing its successful release, the entire experience of the successful completion. This is a way to incorporate your objective as part of your identity, rather than like it belongs to somebody else or just being a really good fantasy. We know that by simply picturing a danger, we can trigger the entire body responses of fight and flight. So, while your unconscious mind can't tell the difference between something you physically see and something you mentally picture, your conscious mind can. So your conscious mind needs to incorporate an evolving story to assemble this imagery and new concept as part of your new story. Otherwise, it doesn't register. It doesn't evolve to transform identity. The key elements are these three. Repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision needs to be renewed and repeated regularly, or it'll just fade away. Secondly, consciously incorporate this new vision into an ongoing story to be metabolized as part of your true self. Otherwise, you'll lose the vision. It will fade. And third, specificity about the experience of having achieved the goal is really important. So, visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience, in other words, changes the brain. A vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. Now, a few of you have heard me tell this story, but it's a vivid story. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was imprisoned, he was essentially isolated, had no physical activity. Before the war, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. On two occasions, he shot a 99. Everything else was in the triple digits. To preserve his sanity, he learned to visualize golf. Each day, 7 days a week, he would decide where he would go play golf. In his mind, drive there. Get out, warm up, take practice swings, smell the flowers, hit each shot, walk to the next shot. Spent 7 to 8 hours a day in his mind playing golf for 7 years. After he was released from his captivity, playing golf 7 days a week for 7 years, first outing, he shot a 74. The power of a vision, of mind over matters. Now, let's look at something I think is really important and cannot be overestimated in terms of the importance of writing. And that's state of mind, because that has to do with your performance zone. We enter and exit states of mind fluidly and invisibly. It's kind of like a precision passing of a baton between relay team members. Each of us has a different set, or a set actually of different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention, any number of experiences and feelings. Each have their own state of mind. Each state of mind is like a software program on your computer. They're related, but yet they're distinct. So a state of mind is a psychophysiological state, an internally organized software program with expectations, attitudes, meanings, and feelings. From an infinite sea of stimuli, the unique software package of each state of mind determines what we see as relevant, and once that data becomes input, how we process it. Just like a software program. A software program that has to do Word processes something very, very different than Quicken. Totally different way of what's relevant and once input, how it's processed. Each mind-body state determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. So, a key element, then, is our awareness of our different states of mind to know which state works best for what purpose. For example, creative writing and editing, two different parts of the brain. So, they need to be distinct and preserved in time so you don't go back and forth, but perhaps pair the more creative time with your biorhythms of when you're most creative. Preserve that time, keep the boundaries and the framework. Think about how you can foster what you want to do by creating a framework and a structure. So, the regulation of feelings and states of mind involves understanding and mastery of access to each of those different states of mind. So, here are some examples of how artists and authors enter a creative state to fit their intended work. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to entering the state of mind she needed to write her macabre literature. Dr. Samuel Johnson, the poet W.H. Auden, maintained a continuous state of stimulation by constantly consuming tea as they wrote. Willa Cather read the Bible to set the right tone for her writing. George Sand immediately went from making love to writing. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite authors, Diane Ackerman, would soak in the bathtub in warm, bubbly water with a pine plank across and wrote by hand on that pine plank. Coleridge used opium. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm so he could later recreate this experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to frame their evolving story. So the point is, the corresponding state of mind in the reader often matches that with the author because the author guides the reader to that state of mind through the senses. The music and voice of the words, the texture of the imagery, the rhythm of the feelings. So Rob will probably not, for his new audience, want to warm up by reading the dictionary and reading some references before he writes. Each of us has a continuum of states with some level of awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even how to enter and leave different states. We become more or less aware of the best state for a creative endeavor, what's better for conceptual planning, and the alertness required for a business presentation to maybe even at the other end of the spectrum, the relaxation that's conducive to sleep. So how do you regulate states of mind? How do you get in state for doing exactly what you want to do? So consider this. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald. They never learned the critical success strategy of regulating their states of mind and lost themselves in finding something external to regulate it, drugs, alcohol, other addictive substances, or people or process. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. So there are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: physiology, how you use your body, and focus, what and how you focus on. There are a couple of exercises in the outline, but what I would recommend is for you to take 30 minutes and listen to the webinar. It's free on the homepage of MentorPath called Master States of Mind. It's a more thorough discussion of exactly what we're discussing here, and I'm not going to go into the kind of detail that is in that webinar, but it's useful, practical detail. There's an outline that's annotated that you can print and follow, and I think it will be helpful to you in addressing this. I think it will be helpful in other respects, too. In your work with clients. The regulation of states of mind to be able to self-reflect, I think, is probably the most important process that we can help our clients do. So let me give you an example of the power of this and then redirect you to this webinar. When Southern Utah University's new head basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team was dead last in his division, 217 out of 217 teams, in free throw percentage. So during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. Using these two principles of the most powerful ways to regulate our state of mind, of focus and physiology, he simply did a three-part mantra to have a cue, and he suggested dribbling the ball twice, and a focus phrase, some short phrase that would help focus the attention of each player to align the energy field of their brain, and then a relaxation, a physiology, such as a deep breath in to breathe in relaxation, and breathe out any tension. So each time the players would shoot, they would dribble the ball twice, say a focus phrase like relaxed and smooth while they were taking a deep breath in for relaxation and a deep breath out to breathe out any tension. Additionally, he would blow a whistle and have them suddenly do this. So he simulated a game condition, because you don't get to line up and shoot 30 free throws and count your best in a game. You suddenly do it, usually when you're off center because somebody's just fouled you. So what happened then is after 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers. And there's a neuroconditioning program, a microsystem on that webinar that is about dealing with emotional triggers. I guarantee each of you will have clients who have emotional triggers who can benefit from you helping them regulate emotional triggers. But for your writing, this is a way to get in state, to get grounded and centered, and enter a state of mind that is optimum for writing. And as soon as you get your place and surround yourself by what you do and have the structure of when you sit down, first order of business after doing that framework stuff is to get in state. So this creates the access to a creative experience, a state of mind that allows flow. Flow is a state of heightened focus, productivity. The ability to create flow allows you to be more productive, creative, and satisfied. Flow is a positive state. It's been studied in the last couple of decades, and it contributes greatly to effectiveness and performance. Flow, from another perspective, is the state of mind of being centered and focused without distraction. This state of mind allows full immersion in the process of concentration and performance that creates superior results. It can also be a great thing to do to get instantly grounded and centered before you receive a call from each of your clients. In the state of mind of flow, people engage so fully in what they do that they usually lose track of time. The experience becomes its own reward, a way of countering distraction, of being immersed in purpose. So here are some things that interfere with this creative process. In other words, obstacles to become aware of in order to avoid them, to not engage them. Waiting until it's the right time. Waiting until you really have something to say. Waiting until you have enough money to justify the time. Considering whether it's too late or not. In your life, I'm talking about. Being afraid of what family or friends might think. Thinking that an appointment with yourself for creative time, it's kind of like an indulgence or a luxury. In the beginning, it's not about where you sit, what paper you use, or what you write about. It's about beginning. In the beginning, your job is to begin. Now, a recommendation here. Consider integrating your writing into other professional activities. We've already discussed how you'll begin to hear vignettes and illustrations to capture. Another strategy, present what you're writing about. Let me give you an example of some of my most favorite writing. One of the two most favorite books that I have done is one that was just released called Engaging the Ineffable Toward Mindfulness and Meaning. Most of the essays in that book were ones that I put together as white papers for the quarterly mentor groups, for the continuing education, for the coaches I've trained who are licensed and specially certified, and would send them a white paper in addition to our quarterly meeting. And it was so much fun. I knew exactly who I was talking to and talked about some things. They're really literary essays, so they kind of took took literary license, but it was that group of people that I was talking to because I knew they'd be interested. I knew I was dealing with some things that we deal with every day, even though we may not consider some of the things of how everybody means something different when they talk about desire or secrets or time or many other things that are the subject of those essays. And I got great feedback because people were interested in giving me feedback about it. So present what you're writing about. When I'm working on a book, I usually only accept speaking engagements that are in the flow of what I'm writing about so that when I'm working on a presentation or a workshop or a retreat, I'm working on a chapter. So here's an exercise. Morning pages. This is in your outline. One way to foster this creativity initially is to do what Julia Cameron describes in The Artist's Way as morning pages. Morning pages are 3 pages of longhand writing done first thing in the morning, totally stream of consciousness. She emphasizes that there's no wrong way to do them, just write. Even if you can't think of anything to write, write anyhow. Don't edit, don't judge, just write. The morning pages are a primary tool for initiating or rediscovering your creativity. Now, insight changes the brain. What we know, and many of you have heard me talk about this before, an aha experience, a moment of insight, lights up 3 different parts of the brain on an fMRI scan, and that vaults someone into a more synthetic and integrative and creative state of mind. Consider what another kind of input does. Facts, information, directives, orders, no part of the brain lights up. So when you solve a problem or do something creative, neurotransmitters immediately respond with a rewarding release of dopamine. Your most powerful way to write effectively is to facilitate insight, to create a situation that gives you a novel approach. You don't need anybody else to do this. You may be describing it to an audience or a person. So schedule, protect, preserve the space for your creativity to live and to unfold. You establish the crucible for this creative force when you set aside time and provide an environment free of intrusions and distractions. I'll give you an example of how I do that if we have time in the question and answer period. So here's a couple of things to consider for any interference with that flow state. These are state-specific issues: chokes, slumps, writer's blocks. A choke is thinking too much about something. You're in a flow, and even for a nanosecond, you think about something which takes you out of that flow. An Olympic gymnast I worked with, just for an instant, would focus on her biggest competitor before she did her routine. That was enough to take her out of flow. So we developed a way for her to totally remain focused on doing what she was doing. Now, I'm talking about sometimes nanoseconds. I'll give you some more examples if we have time, but I don't want to belabor it. These are just ways to think about the importance of staying in the flow of writing and not step outside even for a moment to become an observer or a critic of your work. It's very analogous for those of you who do mindfulness meditation and focus just on your breathing. Inevitably, some thought will come and you'll watch that thought float away or just, you know, not engage it and refocus on your breathing. You may have to refocus on your breathing several times. Same with reverting to your creative engagement and sustaining that creative flow. A slump is an extension of a choke. So this can be something, again, remedied by getting grounded and centered, sustaining that state. getting back to it as soon as you realize you've departed from it. Writer's blocks, same thing. A block, I've heard all kind of analytic stuff and heard analytic papers about it. It's way simpler than all that symbolic stuff. It's simply you just lost your flow. Writer's blocks happen when the writer can't enter a state of mind to create. The creative state seems blocked. So this is about also getting grounded and centered and staying with that. So here's what I suggest to someone with a writer's block. Go through a centering and grounding exercise. Write about being blocked for a 10-minute period of time, because when you're writing about it, you're not blocked. Consider whether the block might be a message that instead of writing, you may need to do further research or simply edit what you already written. So here's a summary of the neuroscience of writing as a wrap-up here. Since old patterns are hardwired, consistency of focus on new experience is what it takes to change the wiring, the neural wiring. Concentrate on new behaviors, possibilities, rather than problems or obstacles in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying a problem won't solve it. Going back into a problem only etches it further in the brain. Even though you may understand it more, it etches it further in the brain. That's how people get stuck in therapy. Looking at possibilities creates new neuronal networks and pathways, or initiates that process. Create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits, to lay new mental maps. Keep your eye on the prize, the completed book. Regulate states of mind and manage emotions to promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left brain and right brain, intellectual and emotional. When you're diverted to an old feeling or behavior or thought, redirect your ideas and your energy flow to the new story of being grounded and centered in the process of creative immersion in writing. This is the discipline and work of writing and rewriting, and the result is ultimately a complete book. Remember that the power is in the focus and that permanent change comes from the consistency of that focus. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. Remember, we know from neuroscience and quantum physics, we get what we focus on. So focus on the right thing, not on avoiding something or not reversing a negative. Focus on the positive. Focus aligns and directs energy and efforts. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Knowledge is inert until it's activated. Put it into behavior. There's some great research in recent time about how important it is to put something into the output channel. And that's the antithesis of passive learning. And finally, think about your new experience and evolving self. How your new experience will require thinking about yourself and your identity evolving in a new way, no longer in the old story. And here's how that sounds. I'm an author. So I want to conclude with some inverse wisdom for authors. I'll tell you a little bit of the backstory here. These are some highlights of the introduction to one of my books, Outsmart Your Brain. I came home from college after my freshman year and announced to my mom that I decided to major in psychology. We talked. She was excited for me. Then she mentioned that she'd made an A in her college psychology course. I didn't even know she'd taken it. I said, oh, I didn't know that. You must have really enjoyed it and studied a lot. She said, no, I just answered everything on the test the opposite of what I thought was right. You'd have to know my mom, very practical. Well, here's a list of 9 things that are the inverse of conventional wisdom for authors in honor of my mom, who thought it was all opposite anyway. 1, burn your bridges. make it impossible to go back to an old habit or way of being. If you decide to quit postponing the completion of your book, make it impossible in some way to go back to postponing it. Create an uncomfortable scenario if you should slip back. Focus on the present without the limiting habit. Reward yourself for proceeding and not going back. Even if you have writer's block, you still don't get to go to the mall during your writing time. 2, do the opposite of what you normally do when you're afraid or worried or anxious or uncomfortable or stuck. If you're uncomfortable with public speaking, for example, avoidance is going to increase the fear. So do more of it. Embrace it. Join Toastmasters. You have to jump into the water because you can't learn to swim on paper. 3, obstacles reveal desires. Show me an obstacle, I'll show you a desire. Instead of figuring out a way to sidestep, overcome, or go around the obstacle, consider instead simply not creating it. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. When you're ready, and here's the coaching component, when you're ready to recognize that you create an obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. 4, discomfort is usually a sign of progress. Moving beyond your comfort zone is necessary for progress. Comfortable is not a place you began. Confidence is not a prerequisite. There are places that you arrive. Moving from a comfort zone is necessary in order to proceed. 5, lean into the unknown. If you wonder whether you can write and sell a book because you've never done it before, lean into the action of doing it. If you think you're too old to do something, you'll be right. You can tiptoe through life very carefully and arrive safely at death. 6, don't believe every thought you have. I'll never be able to write a book. Thoughts lie a lot. They're kind of like my Uncle Ted. God rest his soul, or I'd have to use another example. You don't have to believe every thought that crosses your mind. You're not even stuck with the brain you have. You can make it better. Remember Vincent van Gogh's sage advice. If you hear a voice say, "I'm not a painter," then by all means paint. Then that voice will be silenced. 7, you do not attract what you want. You create what you focus on. Cue your radar for early recognition. Keep an eye open for yellow jeeps, stories, illustrations for your book, opportunities to learn about what you're writing about. A caveat here. Talk about your subject, not the book you're writing. Talking about writing your book could dissipate the energy of its writing. How many people do you know who have a book in them or who have been working on their book for the last decade? 8, you only see what you believe. Let me say that again. Some things have to be believed in order to be seen. And when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. That's quantum physics. This fact comes from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. In quantum mechanics, as well as in the brain, the question you ask influences the outcome you see. A very well-verified law is called the quantum Zeno effect. The mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. Consistent focus then rewires the brain. This was developed by a buddy of mine who is at UCLA in neuropsychiatry, who was a guest in my mastermind group. And it's been an amazing demonstration of how our mind and brain work. Use this law to help you write your book. You'll begin to see more of what you want and need to write about. 9. And the last one. Believe in someone and he or she will show you why you do. Neuroscience has demonstrated that authentic belief in someone activates that person's brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. That person can be you, the author. That's also why I work only with people in mentor coaching in whom I believe, because I know that experience is going to be transformative for them, just the process of believing, not putting it into words even, because sometimes words aren't important enough. But I know they'll teach us both why, and they will be benefited significantly by that. Okay, we're in discussion mode, if you'll manage the background noise. Thoughts or questions or anything about this that would be useful to talk about?
Dave, yes, this is Carol. I wanted to comment on something that you said, and I don't know if I got this from your book, Engaging the Ineffable, or I'm sure one of your books. But in any event, when I entertained the idea of writing my book, what I did was I did a printout of 5 or 6 different sheets of paper, and I put my name, and then I have successful author and executive mentor coach. And I pasted those in areas of my home that I spend time in. So no matter where I'm sitting, I see it. And it triggers, again, the focus of, okay, that's right. That you really do have to sort of reframe your whole mindset about being a writer.
So, and that's a great illustration. So for you, that's working.
Yes, for me. Thank you.
Super. Mm-hmm. That's great. And thank you for sharing that. And that's the essence, after all, of what we do in mentor coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. So it sounds like you need to put them in the bathroom, in the hallway, and other than just make your room. So do more of it. It's working. That's great. Thank you for sharing that, Carol.
Hey, Dave. This is Susan Rome. How are you?
Yeah. Hey, great. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. Okay, here's my deal. I graduated from the University of Georgia with a Bachelor of Art in Journalism. I know I can write. I'm a writer. I cannot get my act together on this book that I have been formulating for 8 years now, and I'm just not sure which way to go. I've done outlines. I've done chapters. I've done so many different ways, but for some reason it eludes me because the I think it's the grief part that's still there. It's going to be a book of coaching and encouragement for widows, and it'll be a Christian book because I'm Christian, and I just can't quite get the outline going.
Tell me in one.
Do you have any suggestions?
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. Will you go along with me in doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell me in one succinct sentence, no more than 12 words, what you want to convey to widows. 12 words.
I want to convey to widows that despite how they feel that their life has ended, that there is a rich, beautiful, abundant life to live without their husbands.
Okay, and I would suggest, that's great. I would suggest the basic rules of clarity, brevity, simplicity. Shorten that, but now apply that to your book. What is the one sentence that you need to apply to complete your book? Same process, one sentence.
If I can do it, you can do it.
I'm talking about you doing it, though, because you said you haven't done it yet. What is it?
No, you were just saying about living as a widow. I said, if I can do it, anybody can do it.
But I'm talking about your book now. Let's focus on your book. One sentence about doing and completing your book. One sentence. Go.
One sentence about doing and completing my book?
Yes. 10 words.
Start writing.
Okay.
Stop being afraid. Let it free flow and just stop being afraid.
That's enough, and you got it. Now, all you need is to create a very specific structure within which you do that. I'm talking about outlining for each day and each week and each month the times you'll be at your desk. You may not do one word, but you're going to be at that desk in case some thought just kind of zips across your brain. You're going to do that, and the structure is what I hear most lacking. You need the structure to do it, and the structure, all you need is a plan and to stick to it. You don't need to have motivation. Remember, we've talked about that before.
Mm-hmm.
You do not need to get motivated to do something. You've heard me say before, I've worked with pro athletes and actors. They're not motivated to go to the gym every day, but they do it because they know it's what they need in order to do what's next.
Okay.
Create a plan, a specific structure that is specific to day and hour and minute.
Okay.
That's your writing time. And then you've got the other stuff. You've got the outline. You know the references for doing the you need the time and the focus each time, and have that one sentence in front of you. Just like we heard, you know, the pictures before. You need one sentence right in front of you that you're going to orient your time to.
Okay.
One other quick question or thought. Give us a report next week. Do it this week if you agree to, and give us a report next week about how it works. Is that a deal?
I promise.
Okay, I promise.
I'll make myself start.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate that.
Super. Well, I'll be eager to hear the progress. One other question or comment before we stop. Remember, next time we're going to add on 15 minutes, if you're game for it, after the top of the hour to have more of a discussion and a sort of give and take, and I'm interested in your input more than we really have time for during this time because so much of it's spent in things I want to convey. So if you have time and can and are interested, be sure and set aside that additional 15 minutes after the seminar is ended at the top of the hour next time. But any other comment or question? Right now. Well, I'll be eager to pick up with you next time. We're going to bring this all together and look at what do you do, how do you think about what you do with the book, you know, the purpose, publishing, the whole business of the book, including marketing and that sort of thing. So we're going to get serious about what you do with it and how you conduct yourself as an author next time. So look forward to picking up with you. Thanks so much again for all of your input and kind of work. I appreciate it. Look forward
Thank you, Dave.
To
all
right,
Dave.
Picking up.
Thank you, Dave.
Right.
Have a good holiday.
See ya.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.